It's Wednesday, February 20th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 292 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 49 minutes. I want to talk now about actual editors, because this is something that I have wrestled with for a long time, and I had all these disparate thoughts floating around in my head, and I think the interview with James Lowder really helped me cement them into a worldview, if you will. And the struggle that I have is the people that I would want to pick as editors are generally people that are close to me, have similar interests, etc., etc., friends, sometimes family. But the popular advice that you'll get from the writer's guide, or you'll get from various writing columns and whatnot, is never use these people because they're too close to you. They'll love everything you do. They won't be honest with you. Blah, 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 blah. And I have no doubt there is some truth to that. You can show your work to someone that is so disconnected from the subject material. They're not, let's say, for example, a sci-fi fan, and you're trying to write a hard sci-fi work, and they just don't get what it is you're trying to do. Or they like you enough, or maybe they're cowardly enough with their opinions, and I hate to use such a harsh word, to where they won't give you honest feedback and tell you your baby's ugly. And certainly there is a value in avoiding people like that, but I feel like that point has been hammered so hard that the pendulum is now on the opposite extreme. And I think that as a writer, there are several traits you ought to look for in an editor. And if you do not look for these traits in an editor, I think in many ways you are selling yourself short. Now, the first one I'll give you is, yes, the person has to be both A, honest, and B, good at what they do. If they will not tell you your baby's ugly, and they do not know how to identify an ugly baby, whatever that may be in your writing, maybe that's technical edits, maybe that's creative edits, maybe it's continuity edits, whatever it may be, then you're not doing yourself any favors. Having them pat you on the back and then you send an unpolished gemstone, to use Chuck's metaphor here, to market is really not going to be a service to you. So certainly that is true. But let me also state the following. First of all, the job of an editor, as James Lowder put it, and I'm going to give credit where credit's due here, because he said as an editor, this is what he does, and I think he's damn right, is he believes it is his job to help that author accomplish whatever it is they set out to do, and to do it to the best of their ability. If that is not the attitude of your editor, get a different editor. If you've got someone who's just shredding you in harsh, condescending ways, and we're not talking about a staff editor from Bantam or Del Rey or whatever, where the sales figures maybe make that a necessary evil, get a different editor. Secondly, this person, when they're feedback, they ought to be positive. That doesn't mean they have to tell you everything is right. What I'm saying is they don't have to be harsh in the way that they state it. They can tell you something doesn't work without degrading you in the process. Because let's be honest, when we've talked about this, the theme that's come up again and again is with authors, we're already struggling to get this done. And if you're trying to write, the last thing we need is somebody else giving us emotional baggage that makes it easier to walk away. Third, their edits ought to be actionable. If they tell you something sucks and leave it at that, if they circle a paragraph and write POV in the margin, they're a worthless editor. They have given you nothing you can work with. I'm not saying they should rewrite it for you, but if they can't at least say, hey, let me give you an example from the thing that I was working on. I don't mean to keep going back to that, but it's just what's on my mind right now. There was a scene where two characters have an argument, and one of the characters had been presented as very strong through the whole thing, and I had an editor come back and say, you know, in this particular conversation, that character seems to lose a lot of her internal strength, and it seems to kind of break the character. Could you approach this in such a way to where maybe one character is arguing with her, but she doesn't capitulate quite that way? He gave me a direction to go with it, and I was able to sit down and recraft the scene based on that feedback. It was actionable feedback. And if you cannot get those three traits, they're honest, they're positive, or at least not harsh, and they're actionable, then you have not found a good editor. You have found someone who, at best, is worthless, at worst, is actually damaging to the process of you getting this out the door in its best form.
Yeah, they are an albatross around your neck, and they should be ditched as soon as possible. Yeah, there are a lot of people out there like that. They're not interested in helping you succeed, and I don't know if that's a matter of distance or a matter of professional jealousy or what, but there is a lot of people out there who just, they don't care if you ever do anything or succeed because they're just too busy circling their own drains, and they can't be asked to help you if they can't help themselves. I mean, that's kind of the thing here. There's like an old adage that I go back to is you can only help others if you can help yourself. And I think that's extremely true of editor. If you don't necessarily have anything out there that other people can read, then you can't really have the right to edit other people's stuff. Like, you have to have some sort of practical creation out there that other people can consume before you start being like, well, I think, you know, this character doesn't do this enough, or this character does this too much, or whatever, you know, without any sort of context from where they're coming from. Because a certain percentage of that is just style. A certain percentage of that is just, there is a specific style behind the way it is being written. But good editor who actually does understand the value of style will say, oh, you know, I understand how this is supposed to work, but it is not doing what you're trying to accomplish. And part of reaching that threshold, though, is having a good, not a theme, but a plan. You have to have like a plan or a vision of what the end result is supposed to be. And from there, you can really edit down to what you actually mean. Because if you're just saying, oh, well, this doesn't make any sense, remove it, that's not very helpful. But understanding what is supposed to happen in the end, it will make a lot more sense. Because then you can say, as you said, actionable stuff. Like, well, you have points A and B. You don't have point D, which is the end point, which is what you said you wanted. So you need to make points C and D now. And that's perfectly logical, because otherwise you're just arguing in a vacuum.
I think there's also value to understanding the types of edits. And this is something that actually got raised when I sent the work over to one of my editors, and he kicked back and said, what kind of edits do you want me to do? I think in some cases, this is knowing what you want from an editor. In other cases, it's knowing the strengths of the editor. Are they doing technical edits? Are they looking for just issues of grammar and spelling, even if they have really no concept of the story's themes or whatnot? I think just about anyone with the right training can do that. There are other people where maybe they're going to be great creative editors. They can tell you, hey, a character works, or a theme works, or a scene works, but can't spell or handle grammar to save their lives. While he didn't edit this particular story, Chad's a great example, someone like that. He can look at something and tell you, at least in his opinion, whether it works or not, but yeah. Don't ask the guy to tell you where to use a semicolon versus an M dash. And that's fine. You know, it's just you have to understand that these people are going to have different strengths, which is why I think there's value in getting multiple editors. Absolutely. Now, there's something else about editors I'm going to say, which has always been true, but has recently become a useful truth. And the truth is this. An author is one person who wrote something. And even if we're not talking about an error, we're talking about something they wrote it because in their opinion, it's good. It's what they wanted there. An editor looks at it and says it doesn't work. But you know what that editor is? That editor is one person with a conflicting opinion who may be wrong. It is entirely possible the author got it right. And I saw this with my own edits. On most of the edits, my editors agreed. But there is a few cases where I wrote something and editors say this didn't work. I would change it. And then the next two or three editors would be like, did you think about wording it this way? And what they were suggesting was the wording I originally had. And I don't say this to bag on my editors. I had the best freaking group of editors I think anyone has ever had in the history of writing.
Yeah.
And I was bragging about them on Facebook and Google Plus both, because I mean, I totally believe this. But the point is, it is one individual whose opinion is fallible. Now, back in the days of traditional publishing, you had to do it. If you want to go and get a book put out by Bantam or Del Rey or Penguin or whatever, you have to do what their editors say because they're the boss. And that may mean mutilating your work from its original course. Yeah. But the great thing about the new methods of publication, if you decide to self-publish, you can ignore the editor. And I'm not saying you should do so. If you're not going to take your editor seriously, don't bother getting them. And you're doing yourself a disservice by not taking them seriously. But if you look at one particular point and say, hey, you didn't get this right, I think I had it right the first time around, you can choose to ignore that.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Dan, because I've gone to a couple of publishing seminars, like 10 ways to get your book out there and in the hands of everybody and their brother, that kind of stuff. And a lot of what they said was basically going the traditional publishing route, which, of course, the people doing the talk, they were in the industry, so they had a very vested interest in you not doing electronic self-publishing, because that meant that they could continue being the kind of, I don't want to say bottleneck, because that's unfair to the good publishers of the solar system here. But, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who kind of take their position of bottleneck, of throttle on the creative process a little bit too gleefully, you know, and they're like, oh, well, this just won't be profitable. Even if it's good, it won't be profitable. And, you know, I think that if you have something that you really want to express, I think that now is the best time in the world to get something published, to get your ideas out there and into the hands of other people, because you don't have that kind of natural throttle on thing. You can express yourself as freely as you want. Like you said, having an editor that you trust will make your ability to converse with the outside world a lot better, because they will make sure that you are communicating what you intend to communicate. But just having someone sitting at the throttle and with a switch that says no, 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 yes, no, 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 yes, and kind of dumping everybody that doesn't pander to them specifically is extremely excellent.
I guess I'd say it, in my view at least, it sort of depends on what you're trying to write. I mean, mm-hmm. with, say, our product, it wouldn't make any sense to do traditional publishing, to me at least, because the market isn't really big enough. We hope you all buy our product, but GM's Real World Reference is kind of a niche product. That's one of the reasons we did the Kickstarter, is to say, hey, are there people interested in buying this? Are we actually going to make any money if we write this? And, you know, would we be better off just putting it on a blog or something if people aren't really interested? And then if you're something that's, you know, exceedingly niche and you're not even going to be able to put together a Kickstarter, but you still want to write it, I mean, honestly, some of the best fiction I've been reading lately is on an alternate history, basically fan fiction, but I'll call it amateur writing because it's not necessarily based on anything, website. And it's just, you know, people putting this up out of their own free will, not making any money off it. And it's because it's these very sort of detailed, nuanced timelines that no one would ever publish because they don't have enough characterization and such, but they're very fascinating in my opinion. And then if you have a product that's really mass market and that you really think you can get a mass audience to get behind, then traditional publishing may very well be the way to go.
I really don't mean to bag traditional publishing bad always 100% of the time. There's still people making huge, just tons of money on traditional publishing. But I think that having the option to say, finished my project and I put it through the hands of a couple of editors and now I can have it in the hands of a bunch of people and they can give me a couple bucks for it. I think that having the choice of doing that versus having to go through the agony and heartbreak of getting like 50 million rejection letters just to find one that will allow you to go into the realm of traditional publishing, I think that there's a lot to be said for that. Just the choice of being able to say, oh, I'm okay with being small time, I'll self-publish, versus I'm okay with having my stuff gone through the ringer and I want to mass publish. You know, I think having that choice is important to the democracy of ideas that we have going for us.
I think that's something worth highlighting, which is when somebody sets out to write something, they kind of have to make that decision whether they're going for a traditional versus a self-publishing route. As you guys have just said, there are pluses and minuses to both. If you get through traditional route, you'll get better distribution because they typically have those distribution channels secured. You're going to get probably more sales. However, you're going to have less control. You may make more money overall, but you're going to make less per sale, and it's hard to say even where those rights end up in the long run. There's a lot of things that figure into that are way too complicated for us to attempt to unpack in the course of this podcast. I mean, heck, there are whole podcasts devoted to this subject, so I don't want to pretend that in the course of what may be a one or two part show that we can unpack all these issues completely. My goal here really is just to kind of give people the highlights to think about here. But if you go through a self-publication method, you have to do the work yourself to get distribution. For example, if you want to be on Amazon, you're going to need to secure an ISBN, and you can Google how do I get an ISBN, and there's ways of doing that. Some print-on-demand publishers will do it for you. They offer a service to get you that ISBN. Will you get in the Ingram catalog? For anyone who's not familiar with the Ingram catalog, that's kind of this mass distribution catalog Or if you go into Barnes and Noble, for example, and you want a book that's not on the shelf, the Ingram catalog is probably where they're going to go to try and find it for you. Or you go to a local small mom and pop bookshop, they're probably going to go to an Ingram catalog to try and find it. Will you be listed there? Once again, with some print on demand or self-publishing services, you will be. With some, you won't. But I do think there has been a huge shift in the industry. There's a reason why people like Tracy Hickman, who enjoyed great success, was a New York Times bestselling author, has moved from traditional print to print on demand. There's a reason why it is now called self-publication and not vanity publishing. There's a reason why that kind of negative moniker has been dropped. It is a viable method. Now, Chuck, to your point, it's not the only viable route, but it does remove a lot of the obstacles that were once in place, though admittedly, it may limit your success. And it also means that a lot more work is going to have to be carried by you, because that editor, as much as I presented them as a roadblock, they also might be right on something. Those big publishing houses have secure distribution channels. You know, they know how to sit down with the VPs or whatever of bookstores and get these books on shelves and get them put on end caps. You know, that's what they do. They've got people for that. But you're also going to work a lot harder to try and get that first break, to try and get the book out in the way that you wanted it to be, which is why I think you've got all these great options. And there are tons of them. You know, there's Lightning Source, Lightning Press. They're different companies despite name similarities. You've got Lulu. You've got Drive-Thru. There are all these different companies out there that each have their own pros and cons. I highly recommend just do a Google search. You can find tons of articles. And don't take any one person's opinions, but look for the trends. But read these articles and see what the strengths and weaknesses are of the different services to determine which one you think is best for you if you want to go that route. If you decide to go the traditional route, in all probability, you're going to have to go with whoever takes you. If you're Stephen King, that may be different. But if you're setting out for the first time, you will probably have to go with whoever takes you. And that's just the ugly reality. I heard it said, and this might have even been on one of the interviews we did, somebody said that everybody has to take a bad deal before they get their good deal. And they said this in the description of traditional publication routes, that you kind of have to get a little bit screwed that first time around to get what you want the second time around.
Nobody can predict the alchemy that caused J.K. Rowling to meet with the outrageous success she had. Nobody can predict that. Everybody is trying to, but nobody can predict it. So I think that if you kind of set your expectations realistically based on the thing that you have to say and the product that you have to sell, I think that you'll go way farther than just being like, oh, I want to be the next J.K. Rowling, or I want to be the next John Grisham. You know, I think that if you sit down and say realistically, okay, I have this thing that I want to sell, and who are the people that are interested in it, and get yourself like three or four different markets of people who would be interested in what you have to say, and then go after the places where those people are, then you're going to do a lot better than just being like, oh, hey, everybody on the street, I wrote this thing. And the vast majority of them is going to get stuck in an echo chamber of saying, oh, well, that's not what I'm interested in. That's not what I'm interested in. And, you know, just you'll just kind of be ignored to death. But I think that if you go to places where you know where you'll be accepted and then branch out from there little by little, I think you'll do a lot better. That's what I've discovered, at least in my research on the subject. Also, as a random aside on Stephen King, I saw one of the cover of one of Stephen King's most recent books. It was like the whole thing was just the word Stephen King in like 90 point font. And then the title of the font, the title of the book was like kind of wedged sort of in between the words Stephen and King. It was just outrageous. I was like, are you serious right now? Are you even bothering?
I was actually talking to John at dinner tonight about name placement. And how this came up was we were talking about the movie All Superheroes Must Die, which is one that Wayne cited a few episodes back as a 2013 must-see movie for him. And I actually just saw it. It actually was pretty damn good.
Which is why I've avoided it like the plague.
But I can't blame you, but I actually did enjoy it. But apparently it was originally going to be called Versus, and they changed it to All Superheroes Must Die simply to put it in the A's, so it'd be closer to the top of the list as people are scrolling down. In fact, that's the only reason I even saw it was there was Carl and I were bored last night. So we were looking through Charter streaming lists. And of course, it starts in the A's. And it wasn't long before I hit All Superheroes Must Die. I'm like, hey, Wayne said something about that. Maybe we should check this out. But something is similar with fiction. With fiction, if you have multiple authors, sometimes it helps to put the one with the name that comes first in the alphabet as the top author, simply as a way of changing how it will sort in lists. Another one, and this is where Stephen King comes in, is sometimes you can look at not where the name is going to fall in terms of top to bottom, but where it falls in terms of who are its neighbors. For example, if you have John Kingsworth working on your book, put his name first, because then you will get stuck right next to Stephen King in the bookstore. And so that's another consideration about how.
So you're saying that we should tab for.
So there are multiple considerations in terms of how you do this. Now, of course, with this method, with our talking about self-publication, that may never be an issue because of the fact that you may never be on the shelves of a bookstore. So let's talk here a little bit. Presuming that you go really either route, there is something that you can't escape. And this is something that I have heard in talks by both the self-published and the traditionally published, which is the hustle. Once that book is out there, your job as an author is not done. Okay? I can't emphasize this enough. You've written it. You've edited it. It's published. It's available for sale. It's not time to go to Tahiti. Your next job has just begun, which is you've got to convince people to buy it, because chances are people do not know you exist and or do not know this book exists. You have got to be prepared to work hard with every angle and every avenue you've got to try and get people aware of this work. Tristan, I've got to give you some credit. When I was on that episode of Dragonlance Canticle, right before recording, or maybe it was right after, you said, hey, I've got this book. Could I come over to Fear the Boot and talk about it? And you know what? I admire that, because that's what it takes. If you don't have the balls to do the hustle, if you don't believe in your work enough to say, I want to go somewhere and talk about it, and I'm excited about it, you are never going to move it, period. This is why authors do signings. This is why authors do panel discussions. This is why authors appear at conventions. This is why people like Chuck and Joel and Tristan go on to podcasts. Let me tell a story that I know I've told face to face to several people, and I've even told on other podcasts, but to the best of my recollection, I have never told on this podcast. The motivating factor for starting Fear the Boot was a failed attempt at book publication. Back in 2002 and 2003, I wrote a full-length novel, went to get it published, got 35 half-sheet rejection letters, where Ouch. It's not even a full sheet of paper. It's an 8.5 by 11 cut in half. So it's a 8.5 by 5.5. Yeah, by 5.5 piece of paper, form letter that just says, thanks, but no thanks. Probably doesn't even have a signature. If it does, a signature stamp. And I only got those back because of the self-addressed stamp envelopes I included with the submission guidelines. And by the way, I was real careful to follow submission guidelines and all that. But I had a few people actually take the time to write me back. And what they said was, we like your work. Your story is pretty interesting. The problem we have is that, one, we don't know who you are. You don't have an established name. And two, what you're trying to write does not fit cleanly into our marketing plan. It's not exactly like Harry Potter, so we can't try to spin it off that way and move units. We don't know how to sell it, and it's for that reason alone we're not taking it. Not because we didn't like the book, we actually liked the book, but we don't know how to market it because your name and its genre are not top shelf enough to move units. And I kind of stewed on that for a couple years, and then come late 2005, got the idea, you know, there's this podcasting thing. I could start a podcast, maybe build some secondary fame, get my name out there. So next time I try to do a book, somebody's not like, hey, I've never heard of you before. Where are you even from? I have seen a change in that regard. I have seen people now come to me saying, we want you to contribute to something because of the fact that we know your name. And I'm not an A-list celebrity by any stretch of the imagination. I am not a household name outside of Fear the Con. But the point is that by garnering some amount of attention, so in a way, I kind of did that hustle on the front end, but I still have to do on the back end. When this anthology that I'm doing with Ember Corvus goes to press, look, part of my responsibility is, no, I'm not the author, but I'm an author. I've got to do that hustle. you know, I'm going to have to pull what contacts I have to get people's attention pulled towards it. I'm going to have to pull what favors I've got to get it put in a booth at Gen Con, or I don't even know what. I haven't decided what. But I want to talk to you guys about that point. What are you doing in terms of marketing? What sort of marketing plans have you developed? How did you go about developing those marketing plans? And actually, because you guys haven't said a whole lot, Joel and Tristan, I'm going to start with you two. And I know you've got one because you hustled me. So you're doing something.
Well, that's part of our extent of our marketing plan thus far is we are appearing right now through the boot. We did a follow-up interview with Postcards from the Dungeon because they interviewed us while we were still in the Kickstarter phase. And so we did a follow-up interview with them, sort of a retrospective, like, so let's talk about Kickstarter now that you've been through the whole process. Beyond that, I can't speak for Joel, but I have no clue where we go from here. Like Joel was saying, it's a niche product. So it's not exactly like this is a game or a system. So like we could go to Gen Con and run some games at Gen Con and try to get people to buy the book there. I really have no idea where to go from here.
Let me give you some recommendations. While they have limited success rates and their efficacy is debated endlessly all over the internet in every industry, you can go after banner ads, especially targeted banner ads towards game sites. You can continue appearing on podcasts. You can do 20 questions with various blogs. Go to a place like Gen Con. Don't run a game. Get on a panel. Or if not Gen Con, fine. Find a local con or even a smaller national con and put yourselves on some panels or propose some panels for inspiration for your games, breaking writer's block as a game master, adapting real history into your game. And in the course of that, you get your name out there, you pimp your product, you've got a few of them with you to sell, or if nothing else, you've got business cards where people can go to get them. The point is, you identify your market, you find out where that market is, and you go to them. Because if you put that book up for sale and just hope that now that it's there, people are going to flood in and turn you into the next New York Times bestseller, it is probably not going to happen. And I know that you guys at least have not taken that extreme, once again, because of the fact that you're appearing on at least our show and Postcards from the Dungeon. But I cannot.
It's probably not going to happen. I mean, it will emphatically not happen, but continue.
What? Okay. Well, go on, Chuck. So what's on your radar?
What's my brilliant plan? I'm still working on my brilliant plan. Trust me, if I had that brilliant of a plan, I would be the next New York Times bestseller. But my current plan is, Chad actually gave me this idea of researching different self-publishing focused podcasts. I know there's a couple of more fantasy-based podcasts that I could kind of get on and talk about where I got the ideas for my setting and whatever, and that might get people interested. I'm also getting business cards printed up, and I'm going to be going around to a number of the local libraries. We have a really strong library association in this area, and they do a lot of local author events every couple months, so I'm going to see if I can get involved in one of those. Unfortunately, we have kind of a dearth, for a variety of reasons, of actual bookstores in the area, although I am still researching into that as far as finding independent bookstores and trying to get them involved in like a signing or something like that. But it's coming slowly but surely. I have no real timetable on, by X day I want to have 8,000 copies sold or something like that. I just want to kind of take it as it comes, more or less. I really love the idea of people being able to read my book and stuff. But I also am not in a rush to get Jim Butcher-style numbers, although that would be nice. I'm not going to rush it and bite off more than I can chew, if you know what I mean.
And I think that is also an important thing, is have realistic expectations.
Going along with that, I'd just say that, like what Chuck said about realistic expectations and all that, what Tristan sort of sold the Kickstarter to me as was, this way, if the Kickstarter goes off and we write this, even if we never get another person to buy a book afterwards, it'll still be worth our while. It'll still make us a little bit of money. It'll still get us a publishing credit, which is useful in the future. To say that you've been able to write something and get it out before is going to be useful in any future endeavors. However, in regards to marketing, I mean, there is a convention in Missoula coming up in May. I hadn't
thought about running a panel there, but that's an excellent idea.
Absolutely. I mean, especially local cons, not just big cons like Gen Con. Everybody goes to Gen Con. You'll get drowned out. You'll be a drop in an ocean full of oceans if you go to Gen Con. But if you go to a local con, build up some credibility, then you could have people be like, oh, hey, it's like people start requesting you at Gen Con, you have succeeded well beyond any sort of rational thought here. So I think that would be a great way to go, going to local cons, kind of building up a following there, and then letting them do the heavy work. You'll come to notice a lot of the better kind of advice, get other people do things for you. That is definitely a good theme here of, if you can get people interested enough in your stuff so that they will be your biggest advocates. I know Pete Timespike, he has been really behind the stuff that I've been writing since I threw some of my ideas at him a while back. He's been really behind it.
Identify your fan evangelists and treat them very, yes, very well.
Yes.
I cannot speak to writing as well as I can another subject, which is podcasting. But obviously with podcasting, we set out and we achieved something. Once again, we're not household names, but no one can argue the fact that we achieved something and we did very well for ourselves in this regard. And I can talk about how we got there. The way that we did it was persistence. We kept putting out the show to the best of our ability, but once again, not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. We had a plan for accountability, for that chain of feedback to keep things moving. And whenever someone came along who was a fan evangelist who said, you know, I really love what you guys do, I want to tell my friends about it, we would do everything we could to support them. When somebody comes to me and says, hey, I'm in a nearby city and I want to put up flyers for Fear the Con, I'm like, great, what's your nearest Kinko's? I will pay to have the flyers printed. You just tell me where I need to send it. In fact, Chuck, there are two reasons you're on this show. One is, obviously, I like you. You're a nice guy. You wouldn't be on the show if I had some beef with you or whatever. That's not obviously an issue. But
you're making me blush.
I'm a little behind on my own forums just because a combination of creative and technical work has been keeping me busy. But the person that brought your book to my attention and kind of suggested getting you on the show was Chad. Chad is one of your fan evangelists.
I know. I love Chad for that. He's
Chad
a great
came
guy.
To Dan and said, Dan, we need to do something to hook Chuck up. Joel and Tristan, with you guys, I've known Trampas for a long time. So a friend of Trampas is a friend of mine. And so when you said, hey, I want to come on talk about this, now by coincidence, it just so happened I wanted to talk about it as well. But I was more than happy to bring you guys on board and do that. But with Fear the Boot, what we did was we had very realistic expectations. We expected that first episode was going to be consumed by about 10 people, and probably 9 of those 10 was going to be us downloading it more than once. And that first
time, we listened like we voted in the innies repeatedly, and behind scrambled IPs.
And that point where we got an episode download, and we're sitting there like, wait a minute, you downloaded it twice, you downloaded it once, you downloaded it. Holy crap, it's a new person. And yeah, but we just,
and then we all go out for pie.
But we just kept at it. And we talked to other podcasts, and we talked about other podcasts, and other podcasts talked about us. And we went out and we talked to people for interviews. And at the end of the interviews, one of the things that we were taught pretty quickly by Ryan Dancy as a courtesy was, and by the way, he was our first interview we had, who's someone who was and is a lot bigger than we are in terms of name value. But one of the things he taught me is when you get somebody on for an interview, you do two things. First, you say, here's a link to what I did for you. I'd love it if you would link back to the interview I just did with you, or whatever the case may be. You know, if you could give me a link back. The second thing he taught us was show appreciation. So when I interview somebody who's got a good standing in the industry, I go to that person, I say, hey, thank you very much. Here's a link to the show. Well, they then go and post that on their Facebook feed or Twitter feed or whatever. And now all of a sudden, here's a bunch of people who have never listened to Fear the Boot before who are coming over to check us out because they're a fan of Person X. And some percentage of them will stick around because they like what we do. The second thing I do is I say, you know what, I appreciate you taking the time to appear on the show. Is there something that I can send you from our cafe press store because of the fact that, one, I want to show you appreciation, plain and simple. I mean, it's just courtesy, and that courtesy does stand alone. But secondly, I've now put something in front of you, whether it's a T-shirt or a coffee mug or whatever, that you're looking at for the next several years that says Fear the Boot on it. I am keeping us in front of your mind. I am building that recognition. And one person at a time, one fan at a time, one evangelist at a time, we went to conventions. We talked on panels. We ran workshops on how to do podcasts. We shared our knowledge. We spoke to the people that wanted to hear it. We were never, ever too good to associate with anyone that described themselves as a listener. When we go to Gen Con, we have dinner with you guys. We game with you guys. It's being available, and it's just being persistent. You're just that bulldog that never, ever stops. And in the process, don't be an ass. Don't become such a pest or such a walking advertisement that you become a caricature of yourself, but you have to always stay at it in some regard and keep looking for ways to promote it, all the while, once again, having real expectations that your first run into the field may only get 10 hits. But as of Fear of the Boot, now approaching episode 301, I can't say 300 because we already did 300, but now approaching episode 301, you know, we now have thousands of listeners. And we didn't get there the first month we were out. We got there by time and persistence and connections. Connections that we worked hard to build. And that's something that I intend to carry over now that I'm getting more serious about my writing. And I hope you guys do as well. Is, look, Tristan, what did you have to lose by asking me if I'd put you on the show?
Absolutely nothing.
Bingo. And what'd you have to gain by me doing it? I guess we'll find out after the show drops. But
realistic expectations, Dan. Realistic expectations.
Right. And I'm not saying we're going to make the man the next New York Times bestseller. Once again, we are not household names here. But the point is, I have no doubt we will at least move a few units for you.
Well, can I just say one thing, though, about, I keep going back to the realistic expectation thing. That makes me sound incredibly bitter. I'm not. I am incredibly optimistic about all these sorts of things, about people being able to create stuff and put it out there and have whole bunches of people, or even just like a handful of people, be touched by the things that you do. I mean, like, look at Fear the Boot. It has touched, as you say, thousands of lives. Yeah, whatever small or large degree they may have been touched, you know, you guys have touched huge numbers of lives. And I think that just being able to finish the project and have it be done and have it be yours and then have it be in the hands of everybody else, I think that is so incredibly valuable to you as a person, to enriching your life. That is what writing does for me, at any rate, is enriching your life. And I think that's what, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, that seems like what it does to you with podcasting, is that it enriches your life. It makes it more full. It makes it more touched by everybody else around you. And I don't mean to keep saying the word touched, but you know what I mean.
No, Chuck, you are absolutely correct. And there are many things that keep me going back to Fear the Boot and Fear the Con. But the primary things is knowing that it is affecting somebody else in some way. What degree? I don't know. I'm sure the vast majority of people are just mildly entertained. There are a handful of people where I know the podcast or the community more often has touched their lives in very significant ways, because they've told me this. I'm not saying this out of ego. They've told me this. There was also something that, once again, I think I've said on other podcasts, but never on this one, at least the best Merck election, which was prior to Fear the Con 3, I think, maybe 4. We had a lot of last minute cancellations in terms of attendance. And we didn't know, as a result, how many people were going to be at the convention. I mean, it looked like it was just falling apart. Now, it turns out it didn't. We got actually a big spike of unannounced attendees, and we actually slightly beat the previous year in terms of attendance. But at the time, it looked like the convention was just falling apart. And I was talking to good old Chris Mace, Papa Mace. I was really in the gutter. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. This convention hall is going to be empty. It's you know, so disappointing. The whole thing sucks, blah, blah, blah. And what Chris said to me, he said, Dan, you cannot control how many people attend this convention. He said, what your job is at this point is, if 5 people show up, you make it the best damn convention those 5 people have ever attended. And what they're going to do is they're going to go home then, and they're going to tell their friends and family that they just attended the best convention of their lives, and word is going to spread. And he's right. That is the best way to move something, is through positive word of mouth. number one factor most likely to get you to do something is a recommendation of a trusted friend, family member, or colleague. Every marketing study will tell you that. But I wasn't even thinking that far ahead. The point that Chris made in that comment that has forever stuck with me was my job was to make it the best damn convention I could for those five people. I would say the same thing, that Chuck, you're absolutely right. Whatever you create is going to touch some number of people. You can't control whether that's 5 people or 5 million, but you can control whether those 5 people or 5 million people got something out of what you did, whether you actually had a meaningful effect on their lives. Even if that meaningful effect is just a moment of escape from a world that is full of endless BS. You know, if, yes, if that's what you offer, then offer the best escape you possibly can. Tristan and Joel, what you guys were about to say, so let me pump this over your way.
With regards to realistic expectations, that's something that's been a part of my life for a few years now, since I've been doing the Dragonlance Canticle podcast. We are not a big podcast. We only have a couple hundred regular listeners. I don't know how many, but I do know that we tend to be rather close with our listeners. We exchange emails with them, and I've gotten to know some of them. And it's really, really fantastic. So even though I put out an episode, and I know not all that many people in absolute terms are going to listen to it, I know that for the people who do listen to it, a lot of them are really going to care about it. And that's really fantastic for me. And as a consequence of that, I don't even track download numbers anymore. I don't want to know. All I know is that the people who listen care. Similarly, with the GM's Real World Reference, when we sent it out there, between the Kickstarter and the drive-through RPG purchases, about 250 people now own a copy of the GM's Real World Reference. And that's not all that many people in absolute terms. But I've been able to receive these emails from people saying things like, hey, I rolled out of bed, I open my email, I find that your Kickstarter is completed, and I have this book in my email inbox. I was anticipating just flipping through it for a few minutes and then getting on with my day. It's a few hours later, I'm still reading the dang thing. To me, that is very meaningful. That's something that I've really enjoyed about the process. Also, with regards to fan evangelists, one thing that has been really useful for us has been not just fan evangelists, but fan advisors. One person who's been on board with this project from the beginning and has believed in it and given us great advice is Fred Hicks of Evil Hat. And when it was like the second or third day of the project, and I don't even know how he heard about it, but we get contact from Fred Hicks saying, you know, hey, I've backed this project, and here's some advice. Put up a writing sample, for example, in your Kickstarter, because this is a great idea, but you two are unknowns, so people have no way of knowing that you can be counted on to produce good quality writing. So put out some writing samples and keep putting them out as the Kickstarter progresses, that sort of thing. Fred Hicks has been giving us that sort of advice through the process, and you know, we are both incredibly grateful to him for this help. So the fan evangelists are fantastic and huge, and if any of our fan evangelists are listening right now, know that we love you. You are amazing people, and you deserve all the high fives. But also, that fan advice is something that's definitely worth listening to.
And thanks to Fred Hicks, of course. As Tristan said, I'd also just like to say his Dresden Files RPG is great reading, so you know, hopefully we can steer a couple people his way in return.
I don't think Fred Hicks needs our help.
Yes.
I mean, that fate Kickstarter was close. I mean, I realize that barely made it, but nonetheless, Fred is a good guy, though, man. We've had him on this show, and I've talked to him a little bit here and there outside of the show. I'm not as nearly as close to him as I am like someone like Dancy, but nonetheless, Fred is a really good guy, so I've got nothing but good things to say about the man. We're going to close this out the way that we typically do, by letting these guys reiterate what they've done real quick and where you can find it. And also, if they've got anything else on the horizon they're working on, you can find out about that. But before we do, I want to mention, first off, there is one subject that we kept talking around in this episode and never got to. We might get to it in a future interview or roundtable, but it is way too big and way too complex to deal with here, which is fundraising, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, all that kind of stuff. I realize we didn't say much about it because, quite frankly, to do it any justice, we would have to devote an hour or two straight to talking about it. So I apologize for that, but maybe we'll come back to that in a future episode if there's broad interest there in it. And maybe even talk about it from a couple angles, not just doing a Kickstarter, but how do you find Kickstarters? How do you track Kickstarters? How do you decide which ones to back?
Actually, with regards to Kickstarters, if you out there in the listening audience are like, yes, I need to know more about Kickstarters, you can go check out Joel and Mai's. Is that how you pluralize that? I have no idea. We did two interviews with Postcards from the Dungeon, which were almost entirely about the Kickstarter process. So you can check that out. And Monty Cook wrote an entire book on Kickstarter. Basically, before he did his Numenera Kickstarter, which was enormously successful, he spent several months doing as much background research as he could. And when he was done, he wrote up his results in a book, which I think is called Kickin' It. And you can find that, I'm sure, on DriveThruRPG.
Okay, yeah, it's there.
All right, I will do my best to find links to all those various things. Real quick, let's do a kind of a review and a looking forward. John, BloodMoonGoblins.com.
BloodMoonGoblins.com, DriveThruRPG.com, Paizo.com.
What's next on the horizon for you?
I'm not sure yet. I'm juggling a couple different things right now. I want to have some long-form fiction published by the end of 2013, but I haven't settled on what.
Okay,
but fair. If you listen to Fear of the Boot, you'll find out before anyone else.
You'll find John's stuff on feartheboot.com.
Yeah.
John didn't have to try real hard.
No,
on the
I've
show,
got this one so, pretty down.
Yeah, so all right. If you want to keep up with John, Fear of the Boot is probably your best place to do it. Chuck, what about you?
ChroniclesOfSpire.com. That will lead you to both the CreateSpace print version and the Smashwords version. As far as new things coming up, I'm still in the concept stages of the next short story collection. So that won't be an immediate thing, but it will be coming eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later. But I don't have like the whole concept is not fully rendered yet. I have a very strange sort of writing process that has a lot of layers to it.
Like a parfait.
Eventually there will be a new short story arc in the same sort of vein as this one, just with different characters and in the same setting and stuff like that.
Okay.
So yeah, ChroniclesOfSpire.com and check it out and read it, love it, and all that other good stuff.
Joel and Tristan, obviously your prior project was done together. I don't know if your next one will be or not, but where could they find what you just did again? And then what do you, if anything, do you guys have coming up on the horizon?
Well, they can find the current project at DriveThruRPG, and it's just search for GM's Real World Reference, and you should be able to purchase a PDF. Unfortunately, we don't have any print-on-demand options set up at present, but the PDF is certainly something you could take into Kinko's or whatever, and so our apologies for that, but it's the best way we can distribute. As for my particular future, as a group together, we don't really have any plans to work together on anything in the foreseeable future, but I have a bunch of short story beginnings for various sort of science fiction stories that I wrote a page or so years ago. I'd like to get back to those. I'd love to try and get published in one of the science fiction magazines, not because they'll pay you very much, but just because, I mean, come on, it's a sci-fi pulp magazine. You got to get published there. It'd be so cool.
Yep, and there's so, only like two that exist anymore. They're dying.
They still live.
You've got to get one while they still exist in the world.
Do it quick. It's like trying to track down Soviet money.
Oh, you just
As for the stuff that I've got on the horizon, obviously following me at feartheboot.com is not hard to do if you're already here. The anthology that I did with Riley, as I said earlier, I believe will be available for sale to the public sometime in the summer. I will give you more details as I get them. I don't have all the details, to be completely honest, but I contributed to it. I think there are 8 or 10 authors in total, but not only did I contribute to it, but also Johan, one of the other hosts of Fear the Boot, contributed to it, and Pat's wife, Beth, also contributed to it. Beyond that, the two projects that I'm working on right now is one is an RPG book I'm working on with Keith Curtis, and the other is a web series, which eventually I hope to put into print as a graphic novel that I am doing with an artist from our forums that I won't name because we're prepping some teaser stuff. So hopefully both of those will follow through. And if not, well, then so be it. And I will come up with a new project and try again, but I'll keep at it till I get it.
There you go, Dan.
Anyway.
That's definitely the right attitude to have is just keep trying because the first time is not always the last.
If at first you don't succeed, parachuting is not for you, but this isn't parachuting. So stick with it. Anyway, I hope you guys who are into writing have found some kind of encouragement or information here. I hope any of you that are not into writing have at least found this a little bit interesting. One way or another, thank you for tuning in. You guys have a great week and great games, and we will catch you guys next time.
Take it easy.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.